court. Let's look at the paperwork, and we're going to begin with an introduction. And to begin my introduction, I'm going to share a little poem that I discovered years ago. It's a children's poem. Some of you have heard me share this before. Let me just read it. When she transformed into a butterfly, the caterpillars spoke not of her beauty, but of her weirdness. They wanted her to change back into what she had always been, but she had wings. Why do I love that poem? I love that poem because I've experienced that. I've experienced a metamorphosis as I've become more aware that there's an invisible realm that is supposed to be the thing that I learn from and derive truth from and learn to dwell in and learn to believe in. And there are people over here going, aren't you getting a little carried away? Or you believe that? You believe that, though you can't see it? Why don't you just come back here and be like, and a lot of us have experienced it very literally when we start to come together and study the Torah of God and realize that the whole word has been given in a beautiful way from Genesis to Revelation, and it doesn't contradict itself. And our Messiah isn't a new message. He is God with skin on, living out that same Torah, and he didn't come to make us realize that he's replacing Christianity and helping us get over a mean God. So we have friends that we love and we've learned from in the past go and come back here and just be like us. But we can't because we have wings. Isn't that a lovely poem? The journey through Proverbs is a dangerous one. It will challenge, convict, and correct. This journey is also an adventure that delights and transforms. It is not for the faint of heart. The Hebrew word for proverb is mishli, which means parable. From the word mashal, the inferred meaning is able to rule. This is important. So, the creator of the universe has provided parables in a holy book to enable us to rule? Really? And if this is true, what are we to rule? And why metaphors and stories instead of just clearly stating what we need to do in order to be who we're meant to be? Have you ever thought about that? I have begun to realize that God wants us to seek out the truths he has masked in his word and in creation. Like a divine game of hide and seek, the discovered truths are more delightful, and the seeker is most thrilled when time and effort are exercised to uncover the treasures God has hidden. How many of you have experienced that? Yes. He has entrusted us to seek him out and to partner with him to become better, deeper people. So when we unwrap this word mashal, we learn that it first occurs in Genesis, when it says, he set the sun to mashal over the day and the moon to mashal over the night. We have parables to enable us to rule, not to rule over others or circumstances. Those are the two things we all want to rule over. We want to fix other people and rule over them, and we want to rule over the circumstances and make them more comfortable, but those aren't the things God calls us to rule over. He calls us to rule over ourselves. That's the thing we don't want to do. And he intends us to be vessels of light, like the moon and the sun, both day and night. In the day, when life looks bright, everything makes sense, but also at night, when it's more difficult to understand the mysterious dark shadows of life's circumstances. And our woman of valor is going to demonstrate to us how to do that. The author of the book of Proverbs was Solomon. Most of us know that. But his name, Shlomo, in Hebrew means peace. Maybe you didn't know that. The word shalom has become a valuable part of my vocabulary as I greet friends and I bid them farewell. The word is packed with comforting meaning and contains a sense of completeness or all being in its rightful place. Even when things feel overwhelmingly difficult, it is possible to find shalom. What does the book of Proverbs have to do with peace or shalom? Well, internally, of course, as we begin to rule over areas of ourselves which tend to be undeveloped and chaotic, we experience more peace. Historically, Solomon's reign over the nation of Israel was characterized by national peace, and it was the only time. The only time. So Shlomo, Solomon, reigned over Solomon's only peaceful time. And of course, he was assigned the building of the most holy tabernacle, the place of connection between God and humankind. We, who had wrecked the peace originally established in Eden, are invited to reconnect with him, to rediscover divine connection and ultimately shalom. It's a big deal. As living souls, we humans also have a body and a spirit. Solomon authored three books in the Tanakh, or the Old Testament writings, for those of you who might be new to that word. The three books that Solomon authored are Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs. Okay, now this gets really interesting, because Ecclesiastes describes the physicality of this life, all right? It really addresses the physical nature of this life that we live. The Song of Solomon, on the other hand, portrays the deepest spirit connection with God. It is considered to be the holiest, the most spiritual of all books. And Proverbs addresses, guess what? The soul, the matters of the soul. Of course, we began in Eden being whole, without tension between the yearnings of the body and the spirit. The connection between God and humankind was complete, as was the connection between man and woman. The fall of humanity brought disconnection and tension between what was intended to be harmonious. I'm going to pause here, and I'm going to give you a little bit of an illustration. It's crude and it's imperfect, but it helps me because I'm very simple-minded. And so years ago, I saw this, and it helped me understand how we are in three, I hate to use the word parts, but we have three aspects of who we are. When God put man in Eden, he was whole. There was no disparity. He was connected. He was harmonious. Well, we all know what happened. We'll be talking a lot about that. But when the brokenness happened, a separation happened. And the wholeness got distorted. So here's what I want you to picture. I want you to picture this as being the physical part of you. And I want you to picture this as being the spirit part of you. Now, the spirit part of you is that innermost part that communes with God. Right? And then the part where they overlap to make a person creates this area, which is your soul. So the word tells us that we are a soul, we have a body, and we have a spirit. Make sense? Mm-hmm. The functions of the body we are all taught in grade school. There are five of them. We see, we hear, we taste, we touch, we smell, and those are so obvious to us because they rule everything from the time we're born until death for most people. Because most people think of reality in terms of anything that they could see, hear, taste, touch, and smell, and beyond that, there is no reality. But here's the thing. Of all true reality, the things that we can see, hear, taste, touch, and smell are but a very tiny part. 99% of reality is invisible. The most real part of reality is invisible. And in the garden, there was so much harmony with Adam and with Eve that their seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and smelling were all subject to what they knew from their spiritual senses, which are faith, their conscience, their discernment, their communion, and their worship.
like it broke. And in the middle, this soul part of who we are is comprised of three main things. It's comprised of our mind, it's comprised of our will, and it's comprised of our emotions. So here we are. We are a soul with a mind, will, and emotions living in a very physical world. And in the garden, these were the senses that were strong and powerful. And they dictated the behavior for a very short time. Some of the ancient sages say that that fall happened within the first 24 hours. And we all say we could have done better, but we couldn't. So this is what happens now. Our mind, our will, and our emotions get signals from over here that are really loud because these became really quiet when the fall happened. And our job is to tap into these, to develop these, so that our soul becomes larger. Because when we listen to these physical signals and they dictate all of our decisions and all of our reality, it makes this happen and our soul shrinks. But as we listen to faith and we begin to understand that we're led by something that we can't see but we know is true, and we listen to those signals of our conscience and we begin to have discernment and we read and we allow the word to create discernment and we have communion with people and with God and we start to understand a soul connection. And then we worship and we begin to really experience intimacy with the invisible God, the Creator. This is what happens. Our soul becomes bigger. And oneness starts to happen again. And this is what Proverbs does for us, you ladies. It makes this happen. And eventually, in the kingdom to come, guess what? There's oneness again. This is the goal. This is the return to Eden. And that's what this life of living Torah and following God and letting each other help us in this journey is all about. We're going from this back to this. Now, is this going to happen in this life? No. But should we not try? Because every single stage of this happening makes us feel whole. Makes us feel peace. That's what shalom is. Does anybody have any questions about that? Does that kind of help you? This illustration really helps me. It helps a lot of things that are kind of mystical make a lot more sense to me. Proverbs that Solomon wrote equip us to rule over those areas of our life that are in the domain of the soul. The place where the tug of war happens, like I just described. It happens between the desires of the flesh and the voice of God's Spirit. The soul is the dwelling place of our mind, will, and emotions, and we get pulled toward what we suppose will satisfy the longings deep within according to our physical senses. We see what looks good and we feel what seems right. However, and this is a big however, if we have invited God to speak to our minds and we have nurtured the awareness of the spiritual part of our being, we are able to respond to his wisdom. That's why the Shema is so important. Hear, O Israel. Listen, everybody, be reminded that our God is one. And we're created in his image. So he's calling us back to one. Oneness within ourselves and oneness with him. We're told of the magnitude of Solomon's wisdom. It's a big deal. In 1 Kings chapter 4, it says, "Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. He knew everything about everything. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard his wisdom." We can't even comprehend the magnitude. But
We're invited to dip into it. And that's what I want all of us to realize and get excited about. Solomon's wisdom was divinely inspired. Most of you know the story. God gave him an opportunity to choose one thing. And in Kings chapter 3, it says, God said to him, because you have asked this thing and not asked yourself for yourself long life, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but you've asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before, and no one will arise like you after. Ladies, we have the opportunity to tap into the wisest man who ever lived. Why don't we? We're going to. And if you've done it before, we're going to do it in hopefully a renewed passion. So as we turn to the final chapter of Proverbs, the focus of this study, it's really interesting. Let's turn there now to the last chapter of the book of Proverbs. I began to understand years ago how the Torah that God gave Moses and is written in the first five books of our Bible are God's heart and personality, so to speak, that he revealed to mankind. And he did it with stories. He did it with stories, and he did it with personalities, and he did it with just a magical way of understanding his heart by looking at the experiences of other people. Because if we didn't have those stories, how would we really know what it looks like in life, and we would feel like we're the only one? But he gave us very imperfect people doing this, and it's great. So then when I came to the book of Proverbs and I started to read it every month, over and over and over, on day one I would read Proverbs 1, on day two I read Proverbs 2, and so on, I started to realize this is the Torah. This is the Torah in bite-sized nuggets. It's like vitamin pills every day. It really is amazing. I kind of consider it like a bucket in a well. You know, wells are a really great theme in Scripture. They're strategically placed in places where divine connection takes place. Think about what a well is. A well is a little place to access water that is invisible when you're up here. Here's our bucket. So we're up here, but we see a well, and here's a bucket. And if we go to the trouble to lower the bucket and access this invisible and seemingly endless supply of water, we pull up just enough to quench our thirst for now. This is like Torah. The sages say that the Torah of God is like an endless ocean. And swimming in it is the same feeling that you get when you're studying Torah and you think, the more I study, the more I know I don't know. How many of you have ever felt that way? And if you've been in the ocean, you get to the point where you think, it's under me and it's around me, and I've been out in the middle before, and it's kind of an ominous feeling. But he's given us wells along the way, and he lets us dip our bucket down and pull up a little bucket of accessible truth that we can apply here and now. So that's what Proverbs has become to me, which is very cool. But then when you get to Proverbs 31, that condenses all of the other Proverbs. So it's almost like all of Torah is condensed in the Proverbs, and then all of Proverbs is condensed in our text, which is why it's so rich and so satisfying and so beautiful. So when we turn to the book of Proverbs, the first nine verses describe something that we assume Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, is saying to him. He says, what, O my son, and what, O son of my womb, O what, O son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to desire strong drink. She goes on to describe what strong drink is intended for. And she basically is saying, you need to be sober. You need to be strong. And you need to give to those who are unfortunate. She says, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and needy. We could break this down and talk about it in detail, but basically, I laughingly say, you know, she's saying, avoid too much drinking and bad women. And some things have never changed when mothers try to protect their sons. But if you boil this down, what Bathsheba is saying to her son is, behave like royalty. You're a king. There's an ancient story. Don't know if it's true. Have you ever heard that saying? It doesn't matter whether it happened or not, it is true. In other words, the essence of this is true, whether or not it actually happened historically. The story goes like this. It was the night before the opening of the temple. And Solomon, being king, slept with the key to the temple beneath his pillow. But he had partied the night before a little too much, and he'd become very drunk, and he had allowed a very bad lady to seduce him in his bed, and he overslept, and he missed the grand opening of the temple, and all the people were gathered and waiting, and he was snoring in a drunken state with a strange woman draping dark fabric with little pinpricks of light so that when he would open his eyes, he would think it was still night and the stars were in the sky. So she took advantage of his weakness. And his weakness kept the people from entering God's presence. Do you see how powerful that story is? Imagine Bathsheba, the wife and mother of the King of Kings, the mother of kings of Israel, admonishing her son to avoid the pitfalls of strong drink and wayward women, and to defend the afflicted and the needy. In other words, she was reminding him to behave like royalty. Solomon himself proclaims that a land is blessed when the king remains vigilant and sober, and I reference that at the bottom of the page. We too are expected to behave according to a royal standard if we are part of his kingdom. This introduction to Proverbs 31 is really important. We are invited to be part of an invisible kingdom, and we are told to behave like royalty. What does that look like? We'll find out over the next 8 weeks. So Proverbs is a book of compressed wisdom made accessible to all who care to dip their buckets into a deep, invisible well of eternal truth. Metaphors and word pictures are made known to us in this practical book to reveal the truths established before time began. The incomprehensible becomes comprehensible as we drink from the life-giving waters made accessible. As I've challenged others, including young kids in my class, if you knew that there was a great treasure buried below the surface of your otherwise ordinary backyard, would you sit around? What would be keeping you from grabbing a shovel and digging like a mad person? Ah, but digging requires a proactive choice and a determination to overcome inertia, and it will take time, and it will take effort, and it will take an open mind. There's a verse in Proverbs that says, "For the waywardness of the simple ones will destroy them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them." Growth and soul work is not for the complacent. Wisdom existed before the foundation of the world. And we're not going to go there, but I encourage you to when you get home. If you turn to the 8th book of Proverbs, it describes wisdom, where it came from, what its purpose is, and it's personified as another she. It is fascinating to consider that wisdom, described as a master architect, was alongside our eternal creator before the foundations of the earth were laid, and the blueprint was, and still is, the Torah. We will see wisdom personified throughout the book of Proverbs. She lifts her voice with an invitation to hear the words by which kings reign. And those who heed her words live life richly, and those who reject her words love death. I have come to realize that fools are not neutral about wisdom instruction. They're actually offended by it. That is true. So what does a rich life look like? It has meaning. Whether in a palace or a small and humble abode, we can experience real contentment. And as we discover, a meaningful life affects those around us in a really powerful way. For those who pursue wisdom, her words are a graceful garland for the head, which is your thoughts, and a pendant for the neck, which is your speech. So, we will revisit these themes throughout the study. Truly, we will. Let's now take our shovels and begin to dig into the text of Proverbs describing the woman of valor. Who has a nice loud reading voice and doesn't mind taking the page that I passed out and just reading it out loud for us? Anybody? Thanks, Beth.
Sure. Hezekiah, a woman of valor. A woman of valor who can find. She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates.
Some of you are really familiar with this, some of you not so much, but for all of us, a lot of those words can almost be cryptic. They won't be for long, I promise. This is going to become a place you go and dwell. And I'm getting ahead of myself. I just get very excited about this text. Thank you, Bethany. So through the years, I have really met a lot of people who resist reading or even discussing the words of this passage because they feel like it'll make them discouraged or feel incompetent. And maybe some of you ladies have even felt that way. I've heard it described as Martha Stewart on steroids or pathetically chauvinistic. I once overheard, true story, a rabbi's wife mumbled, "Oh, I hate it when my husband reads that chapter out loud." She was very reformed, by the way. We begin by agreeing what this passage is not. This is really, really important. This is not a how-to guide to be a perfect wife. It isn't. The woman of valor is not even a literal person. And this passage is not addressed to only married women. She does not represent only women, but she represents all who choose to live accordingly. Are you curious yet? The woman depicted for us in this unique and important passage is an archetype of a divine standard. All right, even that's a little cryptic, but we'll unwrap it. She's a picture of perfectly fulfilled human potential. That's an important sentence. She does not exist in our world, so don't waste your time comparing and despairing. Don't even go there. She is a metaphor of God's beloved bride without stain or wrinkle. We are invited to become acquainted and hopefully over time very familiar with her. We are invited to learn from her and to tap into the divine wisdom she lives out in every possible way. We are a challenge to be inspired by her. She depicts the life of true royalty. Allow her to become your mentor, or in today's vernacular, your life coach. Make sense? The woman described in the final verses of Proverbs is known as the woman of valor, or in Hebrew, Eshet Chayil. Now this starts to get juicy. Chayil is a military term referring to a rampart or a protective wall in battle. It describes one who is industrious or accomplished. This word infers something of great value. The root of this word can also mean to create, to hope, to wait, to succeed, and to mature. It's not a wimpy word. It's not a weak word. This is a very, 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 very strong word. Chayil also comes from the same root word as chayal, meaning valiant warrior. Thus, my other image that I put on your chair today, one of my favorites. In smaller groups in the past, I have started out a study like this by going around and just asking everyone on the very first night of being together, describe femininity in your own words. And it's really fascinating how we come to the table and what we think femininity looks like and what it doesn't look like. And then we go around and we define it again after we're done studying this passage, and it changes so much. And one of the things that changes is you realize how powerful it is, how strong it is, and beautiful it is. Hopefully you're beginning to realize this woman, or Isha, is not weak or timid. The word infers efficiency and having moral worth. One definition for Chayil, and I love this, power under control. The idea of restraint, an ability to hold on, and to be in control of oneself. So, why a woman? Why is it Eshet, the woman? Perhaps because in the beginning, when the first woman erred, things became damaged and broken, God promised to send a Messiah to repair the damage and to rescue. It was promised the Messiah would come forth through a maiden or a woman. She would be the vessel to usher light into the darkened world. This is one reason the woman lights the candles to welcome the Shabbat each Friday evening. Okay? After lighting the candles, it is customary for the husband to bless his wife with the reading of the Eshet Chayil. After the 6 days of striving and labor and mundane but necessary physical engagement, the Sabbath is a small but delicious taste of the eventual coming together of bride and bridegroom. Do you get that? That's why the husband reads this. Isn't that beautiful? And you don't have to be married to be included in the betrothed bride who comes together with her invisible bridegroom every Sabbath. Okay? Sabbath foreshadows the messianic kingdom when brokenness is repaired and the disconnection is erected. The verses in our Eshet Chayil passage are written in an acrostic form. Who knows what that means? Every phrase begins with the letters of the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet. Okay? So each letter of the Hebrew alphabet represents a numerical value as well as a phonetic sound and holds layers of meaning, which all of you who've been around know quite well from sitting under Grant's teaching. This alone would be a subject for another book because we could examine each letter's meaning and apply it to the phrase in our text, which if some of you want to do that, Sharon, feel free. It has been said by wise women of old that a woman or a person who embodies all of the character traits displayed by the Eshet Chayil embodies all of the Torah of the Word of God. Do you get that? Did you hear that? Each phrase begins with a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The sages teach that any person who can embody these embodies the entire Torah because all the letters are there. It's all there. It's very, very profound. As mentioned earlier, she isn't a literal person, but the portrait of one who has not experienced the brokenness and disconnect of Eden, which brought separation between God and man, bridegroom and bride, and between Creator and ourselves. She portrays the return to Eden. And that's what we're doing. We're making our way back to Eden in this life, in this Torah life. That's why we do this. As we become acquainted with this beautiful woman of valor, it is my hope that we will have the courage and the determination to become more acquainted with ourselves and to apply the wisdom displayed by her in order to fulfill the unique life assigned to us. That really is so true. But remember, since she does not literally exist in this physical realm, we are not seeking a person so much as we're seeking a way. Right? That's important. A way to connect with God and the world around us. And you will see her demonstrate that for us. And it'll be one of your favorite places to be, I promise. Besides being an acrostic, another super fascinating and distinctive feature of the description of the Ishakael is that a woman from the Bible has been assigned to each phrase. So each of the phrases in our text, and I typed them for you phrase by phrase, has a woman from the word assigned to that phrase to live out and demonstrate what it means. And we'll be meeting some of these women along the way. It's so interesting. And what I want all of you to do is begin to come up with examples, not only from the word, but from life. Traditionally, these specific women embody the particular characteristics described in the verse they represent. We will dig into this aspect along the way, thinking in new ways about the lives of the women who've gone before us. There's a lovely line in the Song of Solomon, and it says this. It says, "If you do not know, O fairest women, go in the footsteps of the flocks and shepherd your young ones near the shepherd's dwellings." Love that. Love that. So we go in the footsteps of the flocks. We've got women, we have portraits of those who have journeyed ahead of us, and they've left footsteps to lead us closer to the dwellings or the tents of our shepherd. As we take a closer look at some of these women, it will help unearth some treasures of meaning to inspire and guide us. We can begin to establish mental guideposts and markers along the way to keep on the right path and to direct those coming along behind us. So, let us have courage to soul search and to experience more wholeness and awareness of the divine. There is an invitation here to travel on a very obscure path, which leads to becoming ourselves as our beloved Creator intended. But we must be intentional and courageous. And most of all, we must humbly embrace the truth and make the internal adjustments necessary to travel further on this path, shedding the ego along the way to become our most authentic selves. Be warned, though, it is tempting to remain as you are and to stop the metamorphosis and change. The road to becoming an Ishakael is a road less traveled. Your journey will impact many around you. Some people might disapprove and urge you to remain loyal to the world's status quo. But butterflies have wings. Okay. Comments, questions before we go on? So, time moves quickly, always does. This image of an archer, she helps define femininity the way I see it more now as a result of studying this text. I want you to look at the picture. I want you to think of an archer. Another one I love. It's this one. Isn't she beautiful? Mm-hmm. So beautiful. So strong. This is a wedding gown with a sword beside it and some flowers. And those are images that I've collected along the way as my whole idea of femininity has grown and developed. And it has a ways to go because we live in a really distorted idea of it in this world. What is an archer? She has to be skilled, she has to be practiced, she has to be strong. There's tension. Without tension, you can't use a bow and an arrow. Did you know that the word for Torah means hitting the mark? Yeah. It's an archery term, ladies. That's why I chose this image. It's us who are women of Torah who are trying to become Ishakael. And we're trying to hit the mark as close as we can to the bullseye. And it can be lonely, but it's awesome. But you have to practice, and you have to understand that tension in your life is the thing that builds the spiritual muscles that gives you the ability to shoot arrows further. Does that make sense? The further we pull back, the further our arrow goes forward. That's why we go back to Genesis. We don't just go back to Matthew. I like that. Not only does Torah mean hit the mark, but the word sin is an archery term that means missing the mark. That's just something interesting for you to note. We need to redefine terms to help you understand better. Isn't that? So doesn't that, knowing those things, make that image beautiful? Yeah. Hitting the mark instead of missing the mark. And you can start to think of things that are required for a woman to become a strong archer. So as Sabbath approaches at my house every week, I don't always get to do it, but because I'm forgetful, I need things I can see. Because I do live in a spiritual realm, but these things that I can see with my eyes remind me of things that I can't see. And as I sit around my Sabbath table with guests each Friday, sometimes it's just Grant, sometimes it's Grant, Lindsay, and I. One of the things I love to remember as I light the candles, first of all, it's traditional to remember that God is not only our creator, but he's also our redeemer. That's why we have two candles. The other thing I love to remember when I light these candles is we live in two realms at once. We live in a physical realm and we live in a spiritual realm. And the woman of valor, the Eshekiel, the whole point of this text is to demonstrate what that looks like when it's done perfectly right. She dwells right here, ladies. She knows how to have her ear attuned to God's voice, and she knows that that invisible spiritual realm is sending signals to her, and she takes those signals, and then she lives it out in the physical realm with humble perfection, blessing everybody she encounters. So, living in two realms at once. If you think about a candle pictures this perfectly. I brought kind of a zhuzhi candle. It has sparkles and it's gold and it's really pretty. But even though this candle is pretty, which one is prettier? If a candle isn't lit, what's the point? What's the point? The wax in this candle represents our physical body. It's our physical life. It's a cool thing. It's a necessary thing. It's a container. And we need to be good stewards of it. And it matters. The wick of this candle represents the soul. The soul is the connection between the physical part of this and the spiritual part of this, which becomes light. So when the wick, which is the soul, becomes an effective connection between what is physical and what is spiritual, look how beautiful it is. And the thing about light is that the darker the place around it, the more beautiful it is. Light is powerful, and it's very spiritual. I mean, nobody can create that. It just is. Nobody even quite understands light. And we could talk 8 weeks on this. But I hope none of you see candles the same. They're a beautiful image. So I need to be reminded because after 6 days, I'm forgetting again. And we enter the Sabbath, which is such a gift, and it's kind of like a reboot. You know what I mean? C.S. Lewis described our existence in this world as being amphibious, fully human and fully spiritual. And only humans are amphibious. Animals aren't. Angels aren't. Only humans are. So Proverbs 31 describes a life lived in perfect, perfect balance. I emphasize the word balance because that's the key word that we will return to over and over and over again because balance is beauty. Balance is beauty. And anything out of balance isn't quite as beautiful as it can be when it is in balance. Okay? When I was in Israel a few years ago, a friend showed me a beautiful door. You got to see it. It's in a little back alleyway, and it's the door to a synagogue, and it's easy to miss, but when you see it, you just stop. It's a huge bronze door, and engraved on this door is the words from Proverbs 31. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got
pictures on that. You don't have them?
I do. So the first time I saw that door, I thought, oh my goodness, Because in my heart, you guys, and in my mind for years, I have considered this text a place I go. And when I cross over a threshold to enter this place, I leave people behind. Sometimes I have to leave more of myself behind, which is a good thing. But it really is like another world for me that has taught me and instructed me and corrected me. And it's been a beautiful, beautiful lesson for me how to work or walk in balance. How many of you have read The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis? Remember the wardrobe? Remember how the children go through the wardrobe and all of a sudden they're in a magical land of Narnia? That's what that door was like for me when I saw it. And that's what this text has become for me. Only it's not a magical make-believe land. It's a place that's more real than this place. So that's how I view the text from Proverbs 31, the Woman of Value. So let's open that door, shall we? Let's do it. Let's start with the first verse of our text. And the way this is going to play out, I'm not exactly sure. My plan is to discuss an average of 3 of these verses every time we gather. Though tonight, because my introduction has been a little longer than usual, we might not get further than the first verse. So in preparation for Sunday nights over the next few months, I would like for you just to kind of keep reading over this and thinking about it. I want you to pay particular attention to the verses that will be coming up, the next 2 or 3, and start to think and ponder and pray and study and come full, okay? And then we'll study them together. Ishit Kayo. Remember, Ishit means the woman, Kayo means valor. And hopefully after all of these words I've said, those 2 words mean much more. A woman of valor who can find. She is far more precious than jewels. Proverbs 31:10. There's a verse, a beautiful verse, a passage actually, in Psalm 45. You can jot that down. And it says this. It says, a king's daughter is all glorious within her chamber. In other words, it infers that there's a secret place where the king's daughter is most beautiful. I know, right? What does that mean? So if a woman of valor, or this Eshet Kayil, is hard to find, and she is elusive, who's looking? Who's searching? What do you think? Are many searching for her? I think there is a yearning to see her. I think there's a groaning in this world to see a glimpse of what God had in mind for humankind, for kingdom life. I think we're all yearning for things to be restored. Most have no clue about how to pursue it. Some of us are getting a clue, and there's nothing more fun than when you get on that path and you start to uncover treasures. I think that it's possible that this woman of valor represents an individual who really does embody the connected, intimate relationship with God. And though that can include many men who are part of the bride, he allows a woman to personify her. And I think that because we're women, we have a special invitation and responsibility and ability to step into a role that demonstrates what this looks like to the world around us. Does that make sense? I think another who is searching for her is God. The word says that his eyes rove to and fro upon the earth. In 2 Chronicles 16:9, it says he's searching for anybody whose heart is wholly devoted to him. He's searching for her. I believe that she's a portrait of one who makes the most of life in a way that literally brings that invisible kingdom to earth. Can't be done perfectly, can't be done completely. But each of us as women are invited to do it in our own world. That's what the Woman of Valor is about. I also believe that we all crave connection. I believe that people who say they don't believe in God and have chosen to live a life that excludes him, they still crave connection. I believe that most people don't know what they crave. I believe some of us don't usually know what we crave. I think often the cravings that we experience, we assume can be satisfied in the physical, because remember in the Garden of Eden when that thing got destroyed and broken and fragmented and separation happened, the senses that were so strong in Adam and Eve became shrunken, and the senses over here in the physical realm became so dominant that I think that the cravings that we feel deep, 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 deep down, sometimes even in our soul and our spirit, we try really hard to satisfy with materialistic things. And I think that's why so many of us are so frustrated so much of the time. It's like when you go to the refrigerator and Grant will say, what are you looking for? And I'll say, I'm looking for something that doesn't exist. You're hungry for something, but you can't find it. But you know when you find it, you'll really like it. And the craving of our spirit can only be satisfied by connection. Connection with our Creator. And that's what the world craves. I think those of us who want to discover who we are created to be, we have to really pursue finding out. And I believe that the finding is in the seeking. I really do. So let's begin by looking at our first matriarch. The first phrase of the Ishakael, Woman of Valor, has for centuries been attributed to the matriarch Sarah. Now, I want you to think about what you know about Sarah. Her name was Sarai until God changed her name to Sarah, putting a part of his own name in her name. Sarah became a nomad, leaving what was familiar and comfortable to go with Abraham when God called them to a place they didn't even know where they were going. Often he calls us and he says, trust me in the journey. I'm not even going to reveal the destination. And we have to be okay with that because that's what faith is. And somewhere along the way, God came to Abraham and he said, stake out your claim and whatever you decide are your boundaries, that's where you'll dwell. That's what he does in our life. He says, here are your boundaries of your life. I've given you a life. I've given you a personality. I've given you a soul. I've given you a world to live in and fill with life. And that's what Sarah did. She took the domain that God had assigned to her and she filled it with life. But remember the time when God and his, well, the messengers, we can infer who they were, came. And Abraham was sitting outside his tent, right? And these messengers came to deliver a pretty important message. Do you remember what it was? She was going to have a baby. And these messengers ask a question. They said, where's Sarah? The answer that Abraham gave is really interesting. He said, in the tent. There's an ancient Rosh, which is a discussion about what that meant. And Rashi, he's the most famous of all of our commentators, he said that phrase, in the tent, can also be understood to mean she is modest. Modest. Now, we have to redefine modesty. Modesty means you have an invisible, private, inner world that you dwell in, and you're comfortable there. It's not dictated by the world standards. It's not dictated by mirrors. It's not dictated by the halftime show during the... But you have a private inner space that you are comfortable being in, and it's a secret place. It's a hidden place. It's a very, very personal space that only includes you and him. And that's where they say Sarah dwelt. Yes, she laughed. Could have been delight. Could have been surprise. Could have been skepticism. She laughed a little. But in the end, she came. She had a baby. She's still buried beside Abraham in Hebron. And she's a matriarch. And her life is quite the story. So if we consider a definition of modesty as having a strong secret inner life, we start to understand all those phrases in the Bible that talks about being a tent dweller. Because we are invited to be tent dwellers. What do we pray every Shabbat? How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, and your dwelling places, O Israel. We are invited to enter tents. Remember when God said, every man to his own tent, every man to his own dwelling. Go and dwell in your tent. Your tent isn't my tent, isn't your tent, isn't your tent. We all have our own place to dwell in secret with God to create a strong inner world. I keep pointing over here where the spirit was. That's what real modesty is. Isn't that cool? There's a verse in Psalm 61:4, it says, let me dwell in your tent forever. Let me take refuge in the shadow of your wings. There are other verses that say, from my distress I called upon the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me in a large place. That's in Psalm 118. Because the question I ask when I read that verse is, if we're tent dwellers... Aren't tents small? Well, that's one of the things that the caterpillars accuse us of. Living a small world in a small place and being small-minded and shrinking down and following stupid rules made by an invisible God from an archaic book a million years ago. And what does it have to do with here and now? And they accuse it of being a small world. But here's the thing. We don't know that it's a really big world until we go inside. Because from the outside, it looks small. But from the inside, you can't even see the walls. Isn't that cool?
It's just like the wardrobe in Narnia.
It's just like the wardrobe. You can't even see the walls when you go in there. I want you just to sit and think about that for a minute. There's a verse in Psalm 18, it says, he brought me forth also into a broad place. He rescued me. Why? Because he delighted in me. He doesn't call us to a narrow, small life. He calls us to a really big life. But it's a really big life that can look really small for people who aren't in the tent. But if you're willing to be a tent dweller, you experience the delights that only a person who builds that inner secret life can experience. Okay? A tent dweller doesn't depend on outside validation, and it doesn't depend on the affirmation of others. It's a big deal. This kind of modesty doesn't have the need for constant distraction or noise or activity. It means that what I do for the sake of an unseen reality, and I don't even need to be noticed for it. And I know that for some, the idea of an authentic and real inner world with communion with God is just, it's a preposterous idea. But Proverbs 14 declares, the tent of the upright will flourish. Now those verses make more sense to us. You'll start to see tent verses all over the place. It really is a lovely place to dwell. As children, don't we all fantasize about being invisible? I read a very godly woman, wrote a book years ago, and I read a phrase, she says, invisibility empowers. I said, invisibility empowers? How does invisibility empower? Because only when you're willing to enter that secret place that is invisible to the eyes of others in a spiritual realm, do you tap into the power you really have. Not only over your own soul, but in your household and in the world around you. You know, private communion in God's presence, it just doesn't come easily in our fast-paced materialistic world, does it? It just doesn't.
This reminds me of your husband's attempts to explain the concept of praise versus worship. Praise is out there. It's everybody can see it. There's nothing private about it. It's all of, it's look and see. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a it's so fleshy. You know, invisibility is spiritual.
It's so spiritual. Yeah. And let's picture the tallit over the heads of those who are gathered in prayer. They're tents.
Making your own tent. Mm-hmm.
And when you look over a sea of those, you don't even see who's in them. Mm-hmm. Because everybody's the same. But what's going on inside is so
personal
and so powerful. And I love it when we all pray alone together. Mm-hmm. Love that. God's people were in tents alone, together. That's what a community is. Okay?
Time spent in the tent doesn't develop a sense of self-deprecation and false modesty, but it does foster self-awareness. It truly does. And it also fosters self-respect. That's been kind of a sideline and a benefit that has happened in my life as a result of tent time that it took me by surprise. It's an unshakable God awareness. It's not pretentious. It is self-composure, whether you're alone or whether you're with others. That's the kind of woman I want to be. And that's the kind of woman that Sarah pictures, and that's the kind of woman that is introduced to us in the very first phrase of the Woman of Valor. You know, we tend to think of modesty only in terms of how we dress. Truth is, the way we see ourselves and the result of what kind of communion we have with God is obviously going to affect the way we dress and present ourselves to the world. But it's a very small part of a very huge thing that goes on inside, okay? So don't shrink modesty down to a dingy long dress and a head covering. It's way more than that. It also has to do with discretion. Discretion. Did you know there's a verse in Proverbs that tells us that discretion will protect you? No wonder women are so exposed to so much danger these days. But we are told that discretion protects. In Proverbs 11, it says, like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion. Like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion. That is one to ponder. That's in Proverbs 11:22. There's a song that I love. It's a Sarah Grove song, and there's a verse that she sings, and it says, I have become an audience of one. And since I've become an audience of one, I don't worry about what people say or think. I found peace. And that's what tent time is about. I have a few friends in my life, a few are in this room, and we're good about reminding each other, you need some tent time. We start to get grumpy, and we start to get distracted, and we start doing a self-pity thing, and it's like we tell each other, because true friends can do that, because you invite a true friend to do that, right? I don't invite just anybody to do that. But my true friends can come up to me and say, Robin, you need some tent time. All right. We need to learn to practice silence before the one who made us. We really do. Psalm 15, verses 1 and 2 says, O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who speaks truth in his heart to himself. We have to be willing to speak the truth in our heart to ourselves. That takes courage. That takes courage. So there are other women in the Tanakh who demonstrate this beautiful idea of invisibility and secrecy. Esther is one. Her very name means hidden. Did you know that? Her name means hidden. If you haven't read the story, read the story. It's a beautiful story. She's a powerful, powerful example of true beautiful femininity. Nothing weak and meek there. What about Ruth? When she went into the threshing floor and she secretly lifted the corner of Boaz's tent. Interesting, right? You'll start to see these themes and they'll start to mean much more to you. There's so much more we could say, but time is running out, and I want to get to the second half of our opening phrase of the Ishakiah, which says, she is far more precious than jewels. The Hebrew word for jewels in that phrase is the word panin, P-A-W-N-E-E-N, and that word is translated pearl. Now, this is important, because where do you find pearls? They're hidden. They're so hidden. They're in the depths, deep in the depths. Not only in the depths, but they're hidden in an oyster. Is that amazing to think about? The hiddenness of something so precious.
And you have to work to get them open.
Thank you, Annette. You, first of all, very few are courageous enough or even inspired enough to dive deep to find them. So then you find these oysters, and I think it's like one of 20 might have a pearl, and a very small number of those turn into anything perfect enough to be considered. But a costly pearl is worth a lot, not only because of what you can trade it for, but because of what developed it. What develops a pearl? An irritant. Either a grain of sand or a parasite enters into the body of that oyster, and it's uncomfortable for that oyster, and so it starts to produce this gunk, and it starts to wrap around that pearl, kind of like water on a blood blister gives us relief from the irritant. And over time, this irritant becomes something beautiful. Do you see these candlesticks? These are a special gift. The base of these candles are shaped like the country of Israel. The stalk of the rose is placed to represent a place called Sederot in Israel. Sederot is the place where all of the bombs and the weapons, thousands and thousands of mortars come over daily, weekly, monthly, yearly. So this rose grows out of that place to become something beautiful and lit to celebrate every Sabbath. But here's the cool part. The metal that these are made from come from the mortar shells that were shot into Sederot. Talk about an irritant. It's an irritant people have kind of learned to live with. But I love the symbol every Shabbat because I think the things in my life that feel like an enemy, God can turn into a beautiful, beautiful friend, and it can produce amazing light.
It's a tent.
It's a tent.
The oyster
is a tent. The oyster is a tent.
Where we have to struggle with the things that we're wrestling with,
yes,
but the solution is in the tent, and it's turning it into beauty.
It is. It is. And it's easy to say that and believe it until you're experiencing it. And then you just want it. to escape it. You just want it to stop. You just want relief. It's kind of like when you're in labor. And you just think, what good thing could come of how this feels right now? But all pain is birth pain. So viable treasures actually are only found in approximately 1 of 20. And even some of those are flawed. But here's the thing about pearls. They're so unique. They reflect light. Over the centuries, the sages have referred to the gathering of bits of wisdom in one's life as stringing pearls. Did you ever hear that?
Yeah, there's no knot in my string.
Sometimes life does feel like there's no knot on the end and it runs off. But you know what? You take the time to secure these pearls and you don't want to lose the wisdom that you've collected. And then you have something really beautiful. Pearls are uniquely feminine. I thought about it one day. You see, even effeminate men in our day will wear like shiny jewelry. They'll have like a diamond or they'll have other stones. But I've yet to see a man who's even cross-dressing to try to look more feminine wearing pearls. Have you? Isn't that funny? They are so uniquely feminine. There's something going on there. They're just assigned a role in life to tell us something so important. We don't want to miss it. We could go on and on about how an irritant forms a beautiful pearl, and only those who are willing to dive deep and take time and effort and risks can pull them up, and then even opening those things is messy and getting them out, and then you may have a pearl. So the collection of these things in our life that start out as irritants, but we are willing to learn from, can be the very thing that adorns our life. In fact, they are the very thing that adorns your life if you allow it, if you wear it that way. Some of us wear our pain like a banner of being a victim and entitlement, and those, we've lost the pearls in those situations. There's a book called Inner Torah. And here's a quote, and I'm almost on the set tonight. It says, "This is a momentous turn, not to be underestimated. It takes tremendous courage for a woman to look closely at herself, to assume responsibility for her own well-being, to open herself to change. Her willingness is its own accomplishment." It's huge. She is embarking on a process that, God willing, will continue for life, but there's always further to go. Isn't that beautiful? You know, I was thinking about this the other day, and I realized that brides in particular, traditionally have favorite pearls, haven't they? So I started to picture a bride, and the bride I pictured can be found in Revelation 19. You can turn there if you want. And this is where we're going to wrap up tonight's conversation. We could talk a lot more about this phrase, but I wanted to just get started, and then we'll dive deep in the weeks to come with all of these following phrases in the Woman of Valor. So Revelation 19, verse 7. Says, "Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come." Remember, we talked about how that day's coming. "And his bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints." So all of us are in the process of creating the garment that we're going to wear when we meet him. And what are those garments spun and woven from? Our choices, our righteous choices, sometimes including the painful stuff in life, the stuff that requires us to hold our head high and continue to believe and know that there's an invisible realm. And we get our signals from a still small voice, even if the world ridicules it. But she is clothed in this beautiful gown, and she wears a string of pearls in my mind because she's adorned with all the stuff that life taught her. Not threw at her, but all the things that life required her to grow from. So when I think of this woman, I feel like we have found a woman of valor. I think we've just found one. That woman you have pictured in your mind, that's what she looks like. Her gown's resplendent in beauty, and she wears those pearls. It's every experience that she has allowed the hardships and pressures of life to refine her, and she's found them hidden away in a deep and secret place. Isn't that beautiful? I was driving the other day, and my hand was on the wheel, and the sun was coming in, which is a rare thing. And I saw, like, all these age spots. And I go, man, that's a lot of spots. And then I glanced in the rearview mirror, and I saw a lot of wrinkles. I thought, man, that's a lot of wrinkles. And then I thought, spots and wrinkles. I have a bridegroom that says he is busy removing all the stains and spots and wrinkles to prepare me for that scene that we just read about. And I thought, okay, so I'm getting these kind of spots in the physical body, but hopefully that means that they're getting erased on the part of me that really counts. And I'm smiling as I'm driving down the road. I'm going, you know what, I can do that. And it gave me a whole new perspective on spots and wrinkles, and I just had to smile, and I thought, it's okay. Because you know what? I'm 58, and as beauty fades, it's a ship that has sailed. It's okay, because I'm learning how to dwell in a place that is secret, quiet, satisfying, and it's given me a perspective about how to live life that hopefully not only makes my heart at peace, but gives life to everybody around me. And that's what our goal is as we study the Proverbs 31 woman, the Ishakaya. So thank you. I'll see you same time, same place next week. And come having particularly pondered the next few phrases in our text, okay?